It's February 28th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Who's on the show today, Jess?
We've got a hip-hop atheist artist and activist, as well as God.
Oh, that's right. You have God's cell phone number, right?
That's right.
The reception's okay up there, right?
Better than I would expect.
For those of you wondering what the heck this show's about, humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on science, reason, and compassion, which is why I invited our next guest onto the show. Adrian Mayer is a folklorist, historian of ancient science who investigates natural knowledge contained in myths and oral traditions. See, humanism rejects belief in the supernatural, but humanism can also provide naturalistic explanations for why people believe in the supernatural and some of the origins of where our supernatural stories come from, stories about giant monsters like the Cyclops and the Griffin. Mayer's first book, The First Fossil Hunters, explains how ancient Greeks and Romans discovered fossils and invented stories about such ancient monsters. You might have seen the History Channel program Ancient Monster Hunters based on Mayer's work. She is not a cryptozoologist, but she does play one on TV. Now, I'm just kidding. Before anyone panics, we're not going to be talking about Bigfoot hunting or the Loch Ness Monster. There is, according to Mayer, a rational explanation for all of this. She is a visiting scholar in the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology program at Stanford University. I spoke with Adrian Mayer by phone last week. Your work caused quite a stir among scientists as well as classical historians. Why did it cause such a stir when it came out, do you think?
Well, I think one reason is that classical scholars, they didn't have any idea that these fossils actually were being observed in antiquity by Greeks and Romans. They knew the myths about giants and monsters, but they just never imagined that enormous skeletons continually eroded out of the earth all around the Mediterranean would have been seen by the early Greeks. So it wasn't surprising that classical scholars viewed the ancient descriptions of finding the bones of giants as just fiction, traveler's tales, or fantasy. And then, for their part, the scientists who studied the fossils around the Mediterranean, they never realized that such bones were actually relics of great interest to the ancient Greeks and Romans. Mm-hmm. So I think the scientists were really excited to find out that there was a rational, coherent speculation, lots of perceptive insights so long ago. They had been thinking about the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, when people just didn't, they had magical, supernatural explanations for fossils. And then I found out and was able to tell scientists that before the Middle Ages, in classical antiquity, people had perceptive insights. Even though they were in mythical language, they mm-hmm. expressed some real insight into deep time, extinction, and even change of species over time.
Well, one of the most interesting arguments that you pose to me is the argument for the origins of the Cyclops.
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain your thesis on how the ancient Greeks were inspired by fossils to create the myth of the Cyclops?
Yes, well, the myth of the Cyclops is most prominent in Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, about mm-hmm. Odysseus and his sailors who were shipwrecked on an island in the Mediterranean and encountered a huge one-eyed giant who was cannibalistic and actually preyed on shipwrecked sailors. And so this was a story that was familiar to Greeks and Romans for over thousands of years. And it turns out that on Greek islands and even around Italy, there are lots of remains of prehistoric elephants, especially dwarf mastodons and mammoths. And their skulls, if you've ever looked at an elephant skull, you look at it head on, you can go into any natural history museum and take a look, the eye sockets are almost invisible. What you see is a large hole in the middle of the front of the skull, which looks a lot like an eye socket. It's actually the opening for the trunk.
And I have to say that we have a mastodon skeleton here in Albany.
Yes.
And my co-host Jess and I were looking at the skeleton the other day at the museum.
Yeah.
And you're right. That nasal cavity looks like a gigantic eye socket.
It looks like a gigantic eye socket. And so you find the skull inside of a cave when you're shipwrecked, and sailors probably told these tales. And they said, we found not only the skull of this giant ochre, but there were all sorts of bones throughout the cave. It obviously preys on shipwrecked sailors like us. We were lucky to escape. So I think that's a pretty reasonable explanation for the Cyclops. In fact, that was proposed back in 1914 by a German-Austrian paleontologist who was interested in folklore, but it didn't really take off until I brought it up again.
In part of that theory, you talk about the ancient ivory trade and how some ancient people also would exhume mastodon skeletons and use the tusks to trade for ivory as well.
They found what they called marsh ivory. They didn't remember that the Greeks did not know what an elephant was. Not until Alexander the Great went to India and brought back war elephants. So back in Homer's time, during the Age of Myth, Greeks had never seen an elephant. So when they found these great tusks buried in the ground, which came from prehistoric elephants that had gone extinct long before they arrived, before humans arrived, they thought that they were just precious ivory, but produced by the earth. They didn't realize that they came from the creatures that were buried in the ground.
I see. But if someone had removed those tusks, and then someone else found the skeleton, you have a diagram in your book where they sort of assembled the skeleton incorrectly. Standing up on the legs with a big rib cage.
Without the giant tusks, because they didn't realize that the tusks came with the animal that they were trying to reconstruct. And also, the problem with the elephant skeletons that are buried in the ground around Greece, it's an earthquake-prone country. So that whole land around there, the bones are completely jumbled up. And the skulls especially are very delicate. Elephant skulls are porous so that they can swim, and their heads aren't so heavy to carry, especially with the tusks. So those crumble away. So you just find big limb bones like femurs, thigh bones, and shoulder blades, and then the tusks. So you tend to imagine it's a very bizarre creature, but it's a rational impulse to put them together into a kind of giant humanoid monster, the way I did in my book. My husband gave me a model of a mastodon skeleton, and I put it together as I thought that the Greeks would see it, as a two-legged giant with a large eye socket in the middle of its skull.
I don't know the date of the Arabian Nights, the 1001 Nights, and I don't know if you came across this. I know that some of the stories in the 1001 Nights are very old. In Sinbad the Sailor, the seventh voyage of Sinbad, he encounters a cyclops. But I found it really amazing that the description of the cyclops in Sinbad the Sailor says he was as tall as a palm tree and perfectly black and had one eye, which flamed like a burning coal in the middle of his forehead. His teeth were long and sharp and grinned horribly, while his lower lip hung down upon his chest, and he had ears like elephant's ears, which covered his shoulders.
Now, that's very interesting. That is amazing. I didn't know about that particular passage in Sinbad, but it sounds like a combination of someone who has seen an elephant and then has found some fossil remains, and they're trying to reconstruct what sort of giant this was. So
that's what I was thinking after I read your book, and then I read that passage. Maybe it's a missing link. You had mentioned that before the sort of Greek gods like Zeus and that generation, I believe the gods earlier were called the Titans.
Yes.
And I think you mentioned that there were shrines in ancient Greece where people could see the relics of Titans, and those might have been ancient elephant bones or dinosaur bones in the temples as
I feel pretty sure about that, because there were certain areas where the fossils of mastodons and mammoths and giant rhinoceroses and sloths and cave bears were all jumbled up in very dense concentrations, and those areas were known as battlegrounds of the giants or the titans, places where Zeus and the other gods had slaughtered an army of titans and giants with lightning bolts. And the Greeks then would go to these areas, find these giant bones, unidentifiable, bizarre shapes, really much larger than any creature they knew, and the ground where they were buried was still smoldering because its heat, which is low-grade coal. So if it's struck by lightning, it can burn for a very long time. So these were natural facts, and the myths took those into account, talking about these must be giants that had been made war on the gods, and the gods killed them with the strongest weapon that the Greeks could imagine, and that would be lightning. It's a rational scenario for the extinction of these giant creatures that the Greeks knew from the evidence had lived before humans.
You have many more arguments in your book, but can you tell us one more? I'd like to hear about your thesis regarding the griffin, which is sort of the mystical beast that was kind of like had the body of a lion with like wings and sort of a bird beak, and it was known to guard treasure.
Yes, it was known to guard the gold where the Scythians, who were nomadic horsemen of Central Asia, they had access to deposits of gold in the foothills of the Altai Mountains in Mongolia, and they kept the location, exact location of their gold secret. And they told the Greeks and Romans that the gold was guarded by these griffins, who were very fierce creatures with the body of a wolf or a lion, with four legs, and a tail, big talons or claws, and then a head with a fierce beak like an eagle. And they were often pictured with wings, although the wings were very stiff and sort of stereotyped. It turns out that just by following that story from the Scythians who lived in Central Asia back to its source, I did discover that that area where they were mining gold is also a vast nesting ground of Protoceratops dinosaurs. And when I looked at the skeleton of a Protoceratops dinosaur, it's about the size of a wolf or a lion. It's got four legs, but its head has a beak. And there's a frill on the back of the neck that could be taken for wings in profile. And these fossils are found just before you reach the gold, which is eroding down from the mountain. So they could be said to be guarding the gold deposit.
Isn't it believed that dinosaurs are very closely related to birds?
Absolutely. That's the cutting-edge advanced theory of paleontologists is that birds are in fact dinosaurs that haven't gone extinct. And it's really interesting that the ancients, when they were looking at these skeletons of dinosaurs, noticed the bird-like qualities. This shoulder blade, for instance, of a Protoceratops is not large like a mammal or like a wolf or lion. It looks like a bird's shoulder blade. And so they would, anyone looking at that in antiquity would think, well, this looks like a bird's beak, a bird's shoulder blade. These creatures make nests, they laid eggs, they found the fossilized eggs. So this was a combination of a mammal and a bird. And their perceptions were very accurate for a pre-scientific culture.
This is the Humanist Network News. You're listening to an interview with Adrian Mayer about the origins of scientific thinking expressed in ancient mythology.
Jess, were you ever into dinosaurs?
Yes, I was.
You were?
Yeah.
I was a little redheaded dino freak myself. I used to be like, look at a picture and be like, no, that dinosaur was in the Cretaceous period. That one was from the Jurassic. They got it all wrong. My parents were horrified. They were terrified. I've always wanted to have Adrian Mayer on Humanist Network News because I really think that this type of creative thinking exemplifies humanism. Humanism isn't just sitting around talking about atheism. It's about exploring the world, being creative, being compassionate towards people's views, and figuring out why things are the way they are. And I'm going to be talking with Adrian about this in the second half of our interview. You told the New York Times in an interview, the main question that drives you is, what are the first inklings of science? So what you're really showing is, the ancient Greeks weren't practicing science regarding these fossils the way we do today, but they were observing, they were making rational observations, and they were recording it in their myths.
Yes. I think that by studying what ordinary people said about fossils and believed about fossils in antiquity or other pre-scientific, pre-Darwinian cultures, we are actually seeing the first inklings of science. Mysteries, mysterious natural phenomena like fossils evoke curiosity among humans. I mean, it's just you find something like a large thigh bone of a creature much larger than anything you know that captures your attention. It demands explanation, and you have to combine creative imagination along with your observation of the physical evidence, and that's to come up with a rational scenario of how these creatures behave, what they looked like, what they ate, and then finally, why we don't see them anymore. Why did they, how did they all die altogether? And why haven't we seen them in human memory? Creative imagination plus observation of natural evidence, that's exactly what scientists do today in trying to create scenarios about creatures that they will never see alive. Mm-hmm. It's a similar impulse.
Now, you've kind of created your own field, and I was reading that you also kind of invented your own or created your own degree from the University of Minnesota.
I did.
And you've described yourself as an outsider, an ordinary person with ordinary questions, but the determination to find answers. And I'm wondering if in being somewhat of an outsider, that allowed you to make connections between art history, anthropology, archaeology, paleontology. You know, did that help you communicate between fields, whereas maybe a paleontologist would be focusing only on the specific field of paleontology?
Yes, it's one of the ironies of higher education is that the deeper you study one particular field, the more you cut off your peripheral vision. Almost like blinders. I mean, you go very deeply into, say, classical scholarship or paleontology, but then you don't have the time or inclination to look at other fields. So as an outsider, I think I was able to see some patterns that more specialized scholars it wouldn't occur to them. I had sort of a different search image. I mean, I myself had looked at vase paintings of monsters and didn't realize that they looked at like fossils until I had looked at millions of actual fossils. Then I could see the connection. And I think also as an outsider, I think people from other specialties, experts on fossils and classical literature, were very happy to share what they knew. They were very generous with their knowledge because they were relieved that somebody was going to do something with the anomalies that they found and they didn't know what to do with. So they were glad to pass along information to me about fossils found in archaeological sites.
Well, the theme of our podcast is exploring humanist thought. And when I first came across your book a few years ago, I was struck by its humanism. I used it actually in a world history class I was teaching when we talked about the ancient Greeks. And I don't mean to be presumptuous about your own worldview, but I do feel like your work is, your approach is guided by science, reason, and compassion. Because I feel like you are very compassionate about ancient Greeks and those who believed in these myths, and you're very respectful of them.
Yeah.
And here's sort of, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I feel that oftentimes people who consider themselves humanists, they focus a lot on the science part.
Yes.
And they champion reason. But, you know, sometimes in dealing with sort of belief in the supernatural or belief in gods, they sacrifice the compassion and sometimes the reason. So in example, like... So they don't believe that God is real sort of metaphysically, but maybe God is real as a human construct at least. I wonder what your thoughts were on that approach to, you know, humanity and religious beliefs, mythology, and science.
Well, you know, that impulse of humanists to reject supernatural explanations and look for scientific explanations, I think that worldview and that impulse might help explain why Aristotle and other natural philosophers who were very scientifically inclined back in ancient Greece avoided even talking about the large vertebrate fossil bones that everybody else around them was finding and talking about. They I combed the natural philosophers and Aristotle looking for any mention about vertebrate fossils, and they just completely ignored them. And I think that they were able to talk about marine fossils, shells, which looked like ordinary shells. They were very similar to living species, and so when you find those on a mountaintop, you could make a very scientific explanation that would satisfy Aristotle and the other natural philosophers who wanted to reject supernatural explanations. You could just say, well, the waters were very high at one point, and then they receded. But with these giant bones, they would have to take account of the popular myths that everyone had to explain them. And so they wanted to avoid that. And because they avoided talking about religion or myths, even though it was based on actual physical evidence, they missed a lot of the perceptions that the modern scholars have missed about antiquity, just because they couldn't see that myths, even though they're in mythological or religious language, contain real knowledge based on observation. So there is that. I also think that human beings are curious creatures. They have a desire to explain things, but they also have a sense of awe and mystery. And even scientists, you know, the best scientists who work on space or fossils or biology, have that respect for how much they don't know, and the just awe for the mysteries of nature. But that's combined with an urge to find out more. Humans have that urge to solve mysteries and speculate freely about what they can observe and test. So I really do believe that some sort of combination of what you were just talking about is the right way to go.
Yeah, because what it seems like what you're saying is that failure to acknowledge these myths and perhaps their natural origins, it wasn't true science. They were sort of corrupting their own scientific method.
Yes, it's becoming it's putting on some blinders, and you're going to miss a lot if you ignore what is now being called geomythology, which is real natural, real insights about nature. But they're expressed in mythological language, and there's a reason for that, because it goes back to oral history. If you want people to keep telling stories and the accounts of finding giant bones, you have to make it an interesting story so that it can be remembered. And it's not written down, remember. So that's one reason that it's in mythological terms rather than scientific terms.
Well, Adrienne Mayer, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
That was an interview with Adrienne Mayer, visiting scholar at Stanford University. We were speaking about her book, The First Fossil Hunters. She also has another book that recently came out called Fossil Legends of the First Americans, which takes a similar approach to studying Native Americans and their relationship to ancient fossils and paleontology. And her third book is called Greek Fire, Poison Arrows, and Scorpion Bombs, and that examines the origins of ancient biological warfare. You can easily find Adrienne on the internet by Googling for Adrienne Mayer.
What is it about Birmingham? What is it about Buffalo? That the hate-filled, water-filled bunkers in your beautiful red earth, they want to build them in our shiny white snow. And now I've drawn close the curtain, this little booth where the truth has no place to stand, and I am feeling oh so powerless in this stupid booth with this useless little lever in my hand. And outside, my city is bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther King.
Jess, what is this song you're playing for us?
The song is called Hello Birmingham by Anita Franco, and I chose it because we're on the cusp of Black History Month and Women's History Month, and the song juxtaposes the bombings that happened in pro-choice clinics in Buffalo, New York, which is Ani's hometown, and also Birmingham, Alabama, with the church and residential bombings in Birmingham during the fight for desegregation of schools during the Civil Rights Movement.
And you're going to play more of the song later in the show.
That's right.
Well, that's a good, that's an appropriate time to discuss our next guest.
That's right. Our next guest is Graydon Square, who is an artist that promotes rationality and free thinking through hip hop. And in addition to his upcoming album, which is called The Compton Effect, coming out in June, Graydon's also working with other activists and artists on a compilation album for the Rational Response Squad. And if you've heard of them, perhaps you're familiar with their Blasphemy Challenge, which is a campaign where people are recording their own YouTube video explaining their belief and reasoning that a Christian God doesn't exist. I spoke with Graydon by phone a couple of weeks ago, but first, here's a clip from his song, Molotov.
Yeah, my name is Graydon Square. I just want to share with you a little song. You ready? Check it. Product of God and a lie is Osama bin Laden, George Bush, Saddam Hussein, just bottling problems, sticking dirty rags in the top and lighting the bottoms, holding it with a smile to throw it into the growl of cloud. It's bigger than George Bush and Osama, or if we ready for a black president named Obama. I'm trying to fight my own indoctrination. They think they can stop an atheist by saying he's praying to Satan. Oh yeah, I fought the holy war in Iraq, so get your back straight before you stick your sword in my back. God bless the troops, that's kinda odd. America only blesses you as a troop if you believe in the God. So where does that leave me? They tell me to leave G, but at the same time tell me America needs me. See, I can deal with people pointing fingers laughing at me, but if it's one nation under God, then I'll happily leave. Try to draft me then, call me a draft dodger and try to catch me, I'd be the one laughing then. Why would I accept a religion that my slave owners practiced, at the same time keeping the gauge under the mattress? People coming in masses, reverends and chaplains, Buddhists, Hindus and Catholics, even heaven's assassins, secret organizations that convene at the Vatican to discuss how to either convert or beat up the pacifists. I'm the Malcolm X of atheism. By any means necessary, take it to them. This is how I break it to them. Your God is logically impossible and can't even survive the most basic logical obstacles. God of the impossible, huh? It'd be impossible for him to be the God of impossible.
I actually started writing music on my 18th birthday. I wasn't atheist at the time. I wasn't a free thinker at the time. But, I really didn't even start writing about atheism and secularity until sometime about last year when I truly, I guess, deconverted.
And what did you deconvert from?
I was Christian. In fact, I grew up in the Seventh-day Adventist church. I had explored a lot of different sects of Christianity. I spent some time in the Episcopalian church as well as the Catholic church as well.
Studies have shown that, you know, African Americans are one of the most religious among racial minorities in America. What's it like being, you know, a minority as a freethinker among your racial minority?
You know what's interesting about that is it's kind of like you said, being the minority of the minority.
Right.
And what a lot of minorities tend to do, I notice, in America is take a lot of the prejudice and discrimination that they learn from, you know, the groups that do it to them.
Yep.
And then they turn around and they use those intolerances, you know, with the minorities that splinter off from their group. I know that I've been kind of targeted by more African Americans than I've ever been targeted by any other race.
Really?
Just being an African American atheist, it's almost intolerated. And essentially what they do is they cycle bigotry and intolerance. It's the same way that, you know, a good portion of African Americans used to, you know, feel intolerant towards Latin America, the same way that they get it from the Caucasians that they learn it from.
Right. So do you consider yourself more of an activist or someone who's trying to fight these intolerances, or do you consider yourself more an artist?
Well, my relationship with the Rational Response Squad definitely kind of slots me as an activist. However, I think I guess I would kind of be a blend of both. I have to prioritize, of course, with whatever I'm doing. But I feel like through my activism to, I guess, combat irrationality and, I guess, the disease of theism, I can do it through my music and still get the point across. I think it allows me to reach a more of a broad group of people, kind of the shotgun approach, because more people will listen to music than they'll listen to or read pages or read blogs or stuff like that.
And is your music reaching reaching African Americans?
I find that the more African Americans my music reaches, the more intolerance that I get, the more kind of hatred that I get. And in fact, I don't think that I really get too much hate mail from any other race besides African Americans. And I knew that going in because when I was doing YouTube videos, my first video was on African American fundamentalism.
I saw on your homepage, the Compton Effect, that you were sort of speaking to everyone who was hating you, and you're saying, you know, don't hate me personally, but hate my message or fight my message, but not me.
Essentially, I forget where I read it, but essentially the position that a lot of theists, especially Christian apologetics, like to take is they'll attack the person personally, and they won't attack the argument. Because, you know, there's people out there that are doing songs about me and stuff like that, and that's fine. I mean, you're definitely open to do whatever you do, but in these songs, these people are attacking me as a person. But they never address any of the arguments that I make in my songs. See, I don't, when I do a lot of my songs, and not all, but in most of my songs, I tend to present arguments against the case of theism. And what they tend to do is they try to make it personal, like, oh, well, he's an atheist because he's mad at God and he's so depressed and this and that. And it's just like, well, that's great. You can think those things about me, but where is your rebuttal to those arguments? Where is the rebuttal to the evidence that I present against your so-called creator?
Right. So is it kind of like a, you know, a Nas and Jay-Z thing going back and forth?
Not really, because I don't think that I would give a lot of these, and I'll be the first one to say, I'm not anybody famous. I'm not anybody that's quote unquote well known. I mean, if somebody decides to present a good argument in a song, then I will respond to it if it's directed at me. But if someone just wants to come out and attack me and say, oh, well, I'll do this because my God tells me that we were supposed to be hated, then you're not really saying any much. You're kind of reinforcing the stereotype of the paranoid, delusional Christian, and I really don't have anything to say to you. Essentially, you're just showing the level of indoctrination that you've received.
Right.
So if it was something like a Nas and Jay-Z type thing, and I know a lot of people, even I think people within in the camp of the Rational Response Squad, they have a tendency of kind of egging me on, like, you know, you should crush that dude. And I mean, I don't think that lyrically, you know, I'm a lightweight, but I kind of feel like if a person doesn't present a valid argument, why would I even give them the time of day? Why would I even give them the opportunity to capitalize off of something they haven't even done their research on?
Right. So in your opinion, do we need more more free thought music, you know, of all genres, not just of rap and hip hop?
Oh, of course, of course. And I think the one good thing is the fact that I really didn't see very much atheist or free thought hip hop. You know, before I started doing it, I met some people who were actively atheists. Three of them were a part of the Rational Response Squad. And then I started doing my homework and started noticing that there was a lot of pop culture atheists and then rock and metal bands that actually were kind of opposed to theism and wanted to take an active stance in music against theism.
So you have a CD out, correct?
Actually, the original CD that I had did was far before I had deconverted from Christianity. But the CD that I'm doing right now is definitely kind of drenched in atheist arguments and secular humanism arguments and stuff like that. And some of my earlier music from the first album will make it onto the new Compton Effect album. I had a song that I did recently called Dear Journal, where I'm writing in my journal talking about a suicide attempt of when I had found a gun walking home from school and I was going to kill myself. And this was when I was 16. And so, I mean, that's how a lot of my first album was. It was very personal. In fact, a lot of people were telling me that it was too personal. I had talked about, child molestation that I had witnessed and been victim to in my first album. And a lot of things that really go taboo in today's hip hop industry. You really don't talk about those things because I guess it makes you seem like less of a man. But honestly, I don't care. And that's why I guess I'm trying to reach such a vast audience aside from the Christian and Islamic fundamentalists out there. I mean, my audience is really vast at this point. Pretty much anybody who isn't, you know, within the persuasive religious umbrella. I take a special liking to those splinter cells that Christianity and Islam tell that they aren't good enough. Like the gay and lesbian communities, the Hindu, the pagans, the spiritualists, you know, the Wiccans. I mean, pretty much anybody that the fundamentalists pretty much tell you're not good enough. You're born a dirty sinner and you need to repent and accept the true religion. It's one of those things where somebody has to do it. Maybe at least somebody has to fail someone so someone else can succeed. And what it all boils down to is I love making music.
I see what Brandon Kane was talking about. 1,000-mile journey starts with a single step. I see. Yeah. I was never one to attack people. But the world's a dangerous place, and if so, then I carry it on my back, people. And I agree, Bush doesn't care about black people. Look at the state of Louisiana, it's that see-through. And while we were so quick to rush through the tsunami, there's a boy in New Orleans still looking for his mommy. Where's the logic in that? And why am I the only person around that sees the problem with that? We have trouble buying food, but not buying gas. For the soldiers giving orders to guard oil in Iraq. Why is it like that? Why we so afraid to fight back? Why we so afraid to put our foot down and take our lives back? I'm ready to strike back till the gas gouging stops and they bring our troops back and admit to the facts. 9/11 was a smokescreen. Then we suddenly go to war with these people. Now I'm suspect about the whole thing. Money is the root of all evil, and evil is the root of all people, cause people are the root of all lethal. We're a cancer, y'all. Look to another source for your answers, cause money is the root of all evil, and evil is the root of all people, cause people are the root of all lethal. We're a cancer, y'all. How much more are we gonna stand for, y'all? See, liberty and justice is not for all. Patriotism is...
This is Margaret Chin, Chair of Students for Free Thought at The Ohio State University.
My name is Don Sutterfield. I'm Public Relations Chair of Students for Free Thought at The Ohio State University.
And I'm Daniel Merritt from Students for Free Thought at The Ohio State University.
And you're listening to Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. I recorded that a couple weeks ago visiting some students, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
But first, that song that you heard before the bumper was called Roots, and you can look for that on Graydon Square's upcoming album, The Compton Effect. For more information or to purchase that album, visit thecomptoneffect.com. And the album is due to come out this June.
As I mentioned, I was visiting some student groups earlier this month, speaking about humanism and media relations, how to get information about your group into the media. I had an excellent meeting with the Faith and Values editor of the Columbus Dispatch also. It was very promising. That was my speaking engagement was set up by the Secular Student Alliance, which is recently relocated here at the Humanist Center, where H&N is produced. You can learn more about the Secular Student Alliance by visiting secularstudents.org. You can even book me, or you could book Jess to talk to your group. And Jess, we're going to be speaking together at a conference in April.
Yes, we are, about how you can use technology to further your PR strategies and help spread the word of humanism.
That's going to be part of the 30th anniversary celebration of the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard. It will be from April 20th to 21. Some of the biggest names in humanism are going to be there. Salman Rushdie, Steven Pinker.
And Dar Williams will be performing.
The singer, folk singer, rock and roller, right?
Folk singer activist, I would say, is more appropriate for...
I'm going to be rocking and rolling. Anyway, you can learn more about that at thenewhumanism.org.
I was going to say, you're going to be there rock and rolling in your dinosaur shirt, Duncan. Okay, so now is the segment where we would be playing our listener comments. So folks, call our number here, 206-339-4168. Give us your feedback. Maybe suggest some future topics, or as others have done in the past, leave us a bumper.
Yeah. Say your name, and you're listening to Humanist Network News. We love playing those. Hey, Jess, we should also mention that you redid our podcast. You created a new podcast page.
That's right. It's at humaniststudies.org/podcast with a lowercase p. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of now the hub where you can download our shows. You can stream them. You can
find our transcripts. Yeah.
You can look at the HNN e-zine article about the podcast episode.
Yeah. Show notes. Great. So I believe we have a phone call to God next.
Yes, we do.
How did this come about?
Well, Mr. Deity is a bi-monthly video series that looks at God and the universe with a smile and sometimes a wink.
Okay, you found God on YouTube, right?
That's right, I did. Uh-huh. MrDeity.com has 7 of these sort of 2 to 4 minute episodes of various issues, beginning with the creation of the universe.
Yeah, it's really funny. It's basically there's a character that plays Mr. Deity, God,
yep.
And then there's a Jesus character that Mr. Deity always calls him Jesse by mistake.
That's right, and Lucifer,
Lucy,
i.e. Lucy,
Lucifer. Yeah.
And Mr. Deity's right-hand man.
Yeah, these are really... All right, this guy's hilarious, so...
So here's a clip about God negotiating the crucifixion with Jesus.
So, that's... obviously, that's the downside. But, you know, after 3 days, we bring you back to life, and from that point on, it's a slam dunk.
3 days I gotta be down, sir?
I said 3 days in the prophecies, but, you know, there's fudge room. We could put you down late Friday, all Saturday, and then, raise you up at the crack of dawn on Sunday, so 36 hours tops. 35 if we did it on the week that they set the clocks forward.
Boy, I don't know.
Well, you'd be doing everyone a really big favor.
Yes, sir. And what's in it for me again, sir?
Well, like I said, you'd be a partner.
Junior partner?
No. This is full partner. Completely equal, 1/3 vote. Plus,
keep talking, sir.
Yeah. Plus, this could be a really good career move for you. You know, get you in on the ground floor.
Yes, sir. You know, and I must say, I really appreciate that offer. It's just, I guess I don't know why you can't just do it yourself, sir.
Look, you know, I'd love to do it. I'm not chicken, if that's what you're... I mean, I don't know that that's what you're implying, but look, there's a lot of stuff to be done here still. Larry can't do it all. It's time, is what it is. Take time, trying to get the time off. Can't do it.
Right. Sir, and why can't you just forgive people again?
Because of the whole sin thing that's killing us.
Right.
Sin equals death, so you go down and lead a completely sinless life, and death has no...
Whoa. Sir, did you say that I have to lead a sinless life?
I said that before.
No, you didn't.
I'm pretty sure
No, sir, you didn't. No, I trust me, sir. I would have remembered that one.
Well, I apologize then because I was... It's Larry. I gotta take this. Hey, Larry.
Hey.
You're on speaker with me and Jesse.
Jesus.
Oh, Jesus, sorry.
Hey, Larry.
Hey.
Hey, where are you?
I'm about 3 feet behind you. But I am in the 13th dimension.
I was talking with the foreman earlier and we're trying to decide how dark you want to go with
the dark matter.
Yeah, take that all the way to Void, and then back at office, Coach.
Oh, okay, great.
Thanks.
Hey, wait. Jesus was wondering...
No.
The health plan does not cover
crucifixion.
That's good. Did you just come up with that, or is that material?
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
No, he was just wondering how he does the whole sinless life thing.
Oh, it's fully God, fully human, sir.
Oh! I came up with that, right?
Yes, of course, sir.
Okay, all right, I like that.
Yes.
Okay, so when are you coming back?
Tuesday, sir.
Tuesday. Okay, well, how about this, you schmuck? Why don't you bring me back something this time, all right? Get me a T-shirt or something.
Will do, sir.
He never gets me anything. So you got that, right? Fully God, fully human. That's how you do the whole sinless life thing.
Well, that hardly sounds fair.
Why?
Well, are any of these people going to be fully God, fully human?
No.
Well, then, you know, this whole thing, it seems a little bit out of whack. I mean, you create these people, but then you make them way beneath you.
Well, I'm the deity.
Right, but, sir, then you expect them to live up to your standards.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, sir, and then you want to threaten to punish them with, you know, hellfire.
Hellfire.
Damnation. Eternal torment.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, this whole thing, it just doesn't really seem to make any... Oh, you're good.
You're getting the whole picture now.
Oh, I'm getting the whole picture. Yeah, I'm getting it. Yeah, I'm being punked.
You go what?
You're punking me.
What does that mean?
Oh, what does that mean? You're good. Oh, yeah. Oh, what? What does that mean? Yeah. Where are they at?
Mr. Deity, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me on behalf of humanists and people in the world in general.
Well, you know, all I have is time, so...
I have a couple questions about, your master plan and some of the decisions that you've made.
Yeah, although I don't like the term master plan. It's too close to master race, if you could just avoid that. that would be appreciated.
All right. First, we might as well start at the beginning, I guess. Can you explain the whole rib thing to me? I mean, did the first woman really come from the first man's extra rib bone?
Well, the rib was the foundation, and then we built around it. You know, you have to have some basic DNA, so we took it from there. And we just kind of, you know, built the remaining structure around that. And I'll tell you, Adam wasn't happy with it because it was, you know, this is back before the days of anesthesia. So very painful for him.
And so was then choosing women to bear the responsibility of reproducing your way of sort of balancing out the power?
Well, I just felt like I couldn't put Adam through any more pain at that point. So, you know, I'd already taken a rib. What am I going to do? You know what I mean? Plus, he didn't really have the correct anatomy. I could have shot it out the back end, the kid, but, you know, just not cool.
No, probably not. Was Mary really a virgin?
That whole case has been sealed. I am not allowed to talk about it by court order. And that's all I can say at this point. That's, you know, I'd love to talk more about it, but because of the settlement, you know, the whole child support thing and whatnot, I just can't say.
Could you at least tell me, like, whose name did you yell?
You know, I generally yell out Zeus. I mean, if you knew the guy, you'd love him as much as I do. You know, he's a good guy, always been there for me, very helpful. So, you know, that's my preferred name. Oh, Zeus. Oh, Zeus. That's basically how it goes for me.
Can I quote you there?
You can quote me.
So what's the big deal with two people of the same sex doing, as you referred to it on your show, the horizontal mambo?
Yes. Now, that's a whole, I think in, if you've seen episode 7, the one that we recently put up, that was a clerical error. What happened was, I had just gotten back from a game of golf. I was cleaning my golf shoes. I was still in my kilt. I've told Larry not to talk to me while I'm in the kilt because I don't like looking at people when I'm wearing a dress. And he came in mumbling something about needing a list. I thought he said a list of the people who are going to do well, when in actuality he said the list of the people who are going to hell. So, of course, I said Jews and homosexuals because I thought he was talking about the people who are going to do well. That became a big brouhaha. I didn't find out till much later. I was at Lucy's. She was showing me around the place, and she mentioned Jews and homosexuals, and I said, no, that's not them. We realized what a mistake had been made, but by that point, Larry had already been to the printers and had the script printed up. And with printed costs being what they are now, and I don't like to, you know, I don't like to tear down more trees than I have to, because I'm kind of an environmentalist. We just went with it, and I thought I could explain it later, but he thought I wanted something stronger in there, so he put in the word abomination. I mean, it was just a whole big clerical error. I happened to mention that I thought maybe perhaps America could become an Obama nation, referring to the candidacy of Barack Obama at one point, and maybe that's where he got it. But it's just a big mess, and I feel bad about it. And, you know, people have been discriminated against and castigated, and it's just one of those things. Sometimes you don't have as much control as you think you do, even when you're all powerful. So
you think you can maybe help us out a little bit with the Defense of Marriage Act, you know, eradicating that or something?
Well, I don't like to get myself involved in things because, you know, I have a good situation here. Good things happen, I get the credit. Bad things happen, I never get the blame. So my policy is basically just to stand back and watch it happen. And whatever happens, you know, it's all going to be good for me. So I don't really get involved in things in that way.
I had to try, though, you understand.
Right, of course.
In our last show, for this session, which I'm calling Break On Through to the Other Side, we interviewed a band called The Rapture Rite. And they said that not only would Jesus be a fan of their music, which, by the way, is sort of a Boy George meets Marilyn Manson meets Kirk Cameron, just to give you an idea,
Okay, boy, that's a...
It's a pretty big mix, right?
Yeah, that's a range right there.
He said Jesus would actually be in their band, and I just wanted to sort of get your opinion on that, whether or not it's true, and, you know, what part of the band would he actually be in? Would he play an instrument?
Jesus. Are you talking about Jesse?
Yes, sorry.
Jesse's actually a good singer. So I think he would probably make a really good lead singer. Although, he has a tendency to play the martyr, so he might not want to, be out front like that. I don't know, maybe he would play bass, because, the bass, they never get any credit.
That's true. And how do you feel about our president fighting this war in Iraq in your name? I mean, is there any sort of copyright infringement that you're going to enforce?
No, pretty much everyone uses my name for everything they do. At first I was upset about it, and, at a certain point you just get over it. You know what I mean? I mean, they're all going to do it. Not a lot you can do about it. I tried putting something in the top 10 list about not using my name in vain, and then people think I mean, don't say God damn it or something like that. I meant to say, don't do things in my name that I am not actually for. That's what it really was supposed to mean, and that was another just misstep on my part, not just saying it outright like that. But, I like the verbiage, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. I thought that was beautiful, and I went that way, and it's just turned out to be a disaster for me. So you live and you learn.
Yep, sort of biting in the rear there, because people seem to sort of interpret your word or the Bible as they sort of see convenient. Isn't that true?
Oh, boy, is that ever true? And, I'm kind of my own worst enemy, because I basically started out, one of the first things I did was I played a practical joke on Abraham where I told him, kill your son, I want you to kill your son, yada yada. I thought he knew I would be joking. Next thing I know, the kid's on an altar, and I got to send one of my guys down to stop him. I should have realized then these people are not too bright. But, what are you going to do? So now everyone, misinterprets everything I say. They take it to use it to their own advantage. And, it's just exhausting. And I, at this point, I just can't fight it anymore.
So what did the dinosaurs do to piss you off? I mean, they're here one day and then they're gone the next day.
Well, the problem is they were just too big. I don't know how that got out of hand either. That's another one of those things where they started out small and they just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And, I had always intended for the humans to have a time here. And we knew that was never going to happen with these things being so big. And, some of them were very intemperate. So, the T-Rex, you just couldn't sit down and talk with the guy. So it was a matter of, what am I going to do? So, little asteroid. I thought it was a little bigger than I thought. And we got rid of them quick. So it was pretty painless.
That's good, at least. And there wasn't exactly room for them on the Ark, I guess.
Yeah, that's a whole nother, boy. Yeah, that thing was a mess by the end. I'll tell you. Cleaning that thing out was a nightmare.
Is there really global warming?
A lot of global warming right now, and I'm not really that concerned about it because, if the people there do themselves in somehow, I got something else lined up in the end. They were not my the end goal I had in mind anyway. So this species, the humanoids that we have now are nice, and, they pay a lot of attention to me, and that's kind of nice, but... No, they were never the end goal. I had always planned on a species in the future that would far surpass them. So, yeah, not really all that concerned.
Okay. I get you and I get Jesse. Who is Larry?
Larry is my personal assistant. He's an old friend. We've known each other for a very long time. We used to work together in another universe's post-life services. We were both counselors. And then, what happened was there was a backup in the initial life force in Sector 9, so they had to create a new universe to deal with it. I got the call. He's always been resentful about it because technically, probably, yes, he was a little more qualified. But it's not always about who's most qualified. It's about who and how you grease the wheel. So A lot of people think that he is the Holy Spirit, but that's not the case. So just want to clear that up.
All right. I heard you say on your Super Bowl show that you don't provide any help as far as sports go. But
correct.
As you know, it's almost time for March Madness, so I just thought it couldn't hurt for you to say that, for me to let you know that my favorite teams for men's basketball are the UNC Tar Heels, and for women's are the Tennessee Vols. Just wanted to throw that out there. Totally understand if, you know, you're still going to stand by your no help, you know, except for Kobe.
Let it go. Just let it go. Not going to happen.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, Mr. Deity, thank you so much for taking time. I know you have lots of prayers to go and answer now. Could I speak with Brian now?
Yeah, hold on. Let me put him on. Okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Brian?
Good.
Great. So, Brian, what was your motivation for creating the show, Mr. Deity?
Well, I wrote the first episode after the tsunami, and it was basically my frustration about why a good God would throw in something like natural disasters when it's clearly, you know, it affects no one's free will. There's no reason to have natural disasters that wipe out 250,000 people in an instant. So that whole episode was, which is, as you know, as episode one, Mr. Deity and the Evil. And the main purpose was basically just to get some attention for ourselves, because as a filmmaker, it's hard to raise funds without a name. And they always want you to have a name actor attached or something like this. And so we kind of thought to ourselves, well, if we could make ourselves a little bit of a name, maybe we could get some money to do some of our other projects, because I have about 5 or 6 screenplays in the waiting.
What's your goal with Mr. Deity?
Well, now we really want to do this as a half-hour series. We've got a pilot script ready to go, and I'm working on more half-hour-long episodes, which I think would be just fantastic, because right now I'm very limited in what I can do because we don't have any budget, and, you know, it's pretty much this is what we can shoot, us standing there statically talking in front of a white board.
What have your responses been, both from people who are religious and non-religious?
I am thrilled by the response of religious people, because I'm a foreman, as I tell everyone, which is a former Mormon, and I have only gotten one piece of hate mail. Someone who said this is how you're going to end up, and it was footage of dead Al Qaeda and Taliban fighters. That was nice, but other than that, religious people, priests and pastors and whatnot have been writing me, telling me how much they love it, how much they are using it in their services in Sunday school. They're actually showing Mr. Deity and discussing the issues involved. So
that's great. Will you ever show or depict the afterlife in one of your shows?
Yeah, we have. I have a. I don't know when I'm going to do this, but I have a whole episode. Basically, it's written in my head. It's not actually written down, about the judgment, which I think would be really fun. For the humanists, Mr. Deity respects conscience. So, except for unless you don't believe in the boy, then you're pretty much screwed.
Do you hear that? Is it supposed to sound like this?
Mr. Deity, I think it sounds great.
Larry, the whole thing is a train wreck. It's...
Sir, you're being a perfectionist.
Well, yeah.
You had 6 days for this project.
Actually, I had 7, but there's no way I'm coming in tomorrow now. I'm so depressed.
Okay, well then, we really should wrap up the whole evil thing. Sir, Mr. Deity, what you're allowing, what you're not allowing.
Okay, where were we?
Well, we last left off, we had decided, well, actually you had decided, sir, that you weren't going to allow people to harm each other with merely their thoughts.
Their thoughts, yeah, that's good.
Right, next up, kind of a biggie, holocausts.
Yeah, I'm going to allow it.
Okay, holocausts in. Next up, torture. Broad brush here, you got men, women, children, animals.
Babies?
Babies, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it in.
Okay, torture's in. Sir, you are all powerful, right?
What is it?
I was just thinking because the list. It was just. The list. Because the list. Well, the next one, I checked with the boys down in research on this, said we're safe to leave it out.
What is it?
That natural disaster complement, the earthquakes, floods, tsunamis.
Yeah, I need to have that in.
Well, sir, I actually spoke with the head of R&D myself on this one. Sir, I spoke with the head of R&D, okay? He said if we leave this out, it's not going to affect anybody's free will or violate natural law or anything like that. And since you're way over quota on the gratuitous pain and suffering...
Here's the thing. If we take it out, it's going to be way too easy for people to believe in me.
No, sir, let me go over the list. Holocausts, torture, and Down syndrome. Those three alone make it kind of hard to believe in you.
No, I don't think so.
Sir, really, if you had the natural disasters, you got earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, you throw in a hard winter or two, no one's going to believe in you.
Sure they will. So is that it? Can we go, or is...
No, not even close. Conjoined twins.
We're going to be here all night. Yeah, leave it.
Okay, conjoined twins. Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah, leave it in.
Okay, leave it
in. Oh, but wait for Lou.
Wait for Lou. Makes sense.
That was a clip from Mr. Deity. For more information about the show or to see more episodes, visit MrDeity.com. And by the way, Mr. Deity is actually played by the producer, writer, and creator and musician of the show, Brian Dalton, who is an amazingly talented guy.
So that wasn't really God on the phone?
Apparently not, Duncan.
Now, Jess, that was actually part of an ongoing series you're working on called...
Break On Through, that's right. I think that a conversation with God / Brian would suffice.
Yeah, that was a breakthrough between humanists and the religious believers.
That's right. Next month, we might try to get on the phone with Kirk Cameron.
Yeah, we should get Kirk Cameron on the phone, I think so. Well, that's it for our show this month. Don't forget to call our listener comment line at 206-339-4168.
You can also visit us on the web at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
The use of our theme song, I Ain't Afraid, is made possible by the artist Holly Near through her generous donation. You can visit her at hollynear.com.
And we're going to finish with the second half of the song Hello Birmingham by Ani DiFranco. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Hello, Birmingham. It's Buffalo. I heard you had some trouble down there again. Just call and I'll let you know. Somebody understands. I was once escorted through the doors of a clinic by a man in a bulletproof vest, and no bombs went off that day. So I am still here to say, Birmingham, I'm wishing you all of my best. Oh, Birmingham, I'm wishing you all.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.